Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Storytellers in Hollywood are aware of some of this stuff. They are incorporating it into modern stories.
Yeah.
Of course, we know the movie The Gods of Egypt and Clash of the Titans, but there are more modern stories. Like, for example, the new Marvel series, Moon Knight. Well, he's a hero who is fighting the gods of Egypt. Now, they're good gods of Egypt and bad gods of Egypt. It does get fascinating, and it does bring in the Egyptian mythology and the gods, and they're bringing them in as gods, which is interesting. Marvel's becoming more supernatural, you know? And they used to have just Thor, and now they're going to have this, and maybe there's more on the horizon. But there are other stories, too. Wonder Woman, for example, the original Wonder Woman story, Ares, the god of war, very much was sort of catching this notion of he was this territorial power who was influencing World War, was it one or two? I can't remember. I think it was two. And they depicted it that way. So even Hollywood is drawn, the Eternals, another Marvel. I guess Marvel's
great.
Really being drawn into this world. Although...
Well, Marvel is a god too. That's the...
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Marvel is a Greek god. All this and more coming up on this episode of the Truth Seeker Podcast. Really quick, before we get started, if you are blessed by this ministry, if you're blessed by this platform, anything that I bring to the table, I ask you to partner with me via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/truthseeker and you unlock rewards, my entire discography of music, webinars, meditations, weekly hangouts, and so much more. patreon.com/truthseeker. Seeker, go check it out.
Won't you come and take me away? I just wanna be with you. Won't you come and take me away? To a place to walk on troubled seas, faith to stand when I don't believe. I just wanna be with you. Won't you
now locked into the Truth Seeker Podcast.
Gargoyles, psychics, everything's ungodly. Dark Savage.
Streaming live at truthseeker.com.
She's not a Christian.
Give it up, y'all.
Your portal to the paranormal, esoteric, and all things spiritual.
She's tampering in Dark Savage stuff.
And now, your host, Truth Seeker.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to the Truth Seeker Podcast. I'm your host, Truth Seeker. Today, my guest is Brian Gadawa. Brian, welcome back to the Truth Seeker Podcast, brother. How are you?
Good, thanks. Can I actually say your real name, or do I have to say Truth Seeker?
Truth is fine.
Truth.
Or Derek.
Thanks,
it
Truth.
Doesn't matter. Truth is just
all right,
easier.
Derek.
What up, Truth? My friends call me Truth.
Gotcha. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, well, that's a pretty tall order to have as a name. So.
I know, right? The Truth. Who's Truth now?
Yeah, I am Truth.
Yeah. You shall address me as the Truth.
Yeah, that's right.
Man, you're like probably the guest I've had on the most on the podcast. We've done probably four or five talks. I have this thing where like usually when I have a guest on, I try to exhaust the conversation. Like I try to ask all the questions. And I tell you what, as I'm studying a lot more recently, I've been ending the show because the guest has to go with a lot more questions. So maybe we can unpack some stuff because I've been studying the giants. I've been studying the gods and all that good stuff. And I know that's what your book series has been about and your new books that you've brought to the table. Moses Against the Gods, is it?
Yes, Moses Against the Gods of Egypt.
And I've been studying that, and I got a lot of questions. And it's fun to have people to roll ideas off of, right?
Sure.
So sure. We're gonna dive into that.
Great.
So tell us a little bit about the series, just for those who are new to your work, right? If they're new to my work, they've, you know, in a sense, they've never heard you, but we've done, this is number four, I think, but kind of give an overview of your work, and then we'll piggytail it back into the new one.
Sure. The novel is one, like the third in a new series called Chronicles of the Watchers. Chronicles of the Watchers sort of retells ancient history stories through the paradigm, the Watcher paradigm, which is the biblical and ancient Near Eastern notion that there are spiritual principalities or powers that are over earthly powers. And that's a concept that you and I have talked about in the past. It is connected to the Nephilim and all that, but specifically the Watchers is this notion that, you know, at the Tower of Babel in Deuteronomy 32, the Bible talks about how at the Tower of Babel, God separated the nations and the languages, and he did so, and he placed them under the authority of the sons of God, and they were allotted to them. That's a terminology that has to do with inheritance and land, but also it's an ownership issue, right? So that, in other words, he's saying that these Gentile nations who refused to worship Yahweh were placed under the authority of these sons of God. And, you know, I argue that the Bible is pretty clear that these sons of God are wicked beings, ultimately. They're fallen from God's counsel in the sense that Psalm 82 and Psalm 58 and some other passages clearly indicate that they're bad, wicked rulers over the people, over the nations. And it's sort of like this is connected to the ancient Israelite notion of the Gentile nations are sort of lost in darkness, and Israel alone has the light with Yahweh, and that's sort of the you know, one of the major concepts in the Old Testament. Well, this idea of Watchers of the Nations is a fascinating concept that I actually began with in a previous series called Chronicles of the Nephilim. And I went through the Bible and I retold, and the first book in that series is Noah Primeval, and then Enoch Primordial. Then I go into Abraham and David, and I ultimately end with Jesus. And so I retell about eight or so different significant stories in the Bible that have connections to the Nephilim giants. That's why it's Chronicles of Nephilim, but also these Watchers. And the premise of these series, so the new series, Chronicles of the Watchers, is, to be honest, it's sort of like I'm filling in some of the gaps that I left in my original series, Chronicles of the Nephilim, so you could like sort of interweave the series if you want, or read the books individually, it doesn't matter, but they do have an interwoven storyline. And so, I wanted to depict this theological thread in the Bible, and my goal was to retell the biblical stories that have these Nephilim or Watchers in them to sort of illuminate the spiritual world. So I'm retelling biblical stories. I'm as a believing Christian, you know, I believe the Bible is God's word, and so I have a high respect for it, and I want to be consistent with the Bible. But I'm also, you know, filling in between the lines because the Bible doesn't tell everything, and I wanted to speculate a little, like, you know, the Bible talks about there's an angelic realm with angels and demons, right? But it doesn't. It just gives us glimpses, very, very short glimpses of it. So I wanted to say, well, what's going on in that spiritual realm while these historical biblical events are occurring? Particularly if there really are, like the Bible says, if there are these watchers, these territorial powers. And it says that when there's a war on earth, there's a war in heaven. It's like, wow, what does that look like, right? So that's my attempt to sort of retell these stories with that fantastic edge and the supernatural, and give a sense of what that might look like. And that's sort of the premise of all these books. And the latest book is, as we said, Moses Against the Gods of Egypt. And of course, that's really important because we all know the 10 plagues of Egypt, right? And or at least we know about them. And in the Bible, the reason why I wrote this particular novel was I felt it fit in the paradigm because in Exodus 12:12, it says, God, Yahweh says, I will execute judgment upon the gods of Egypt. And I don't think this is just a metaphorical thing going on here. And so the other element of all my series, it's sort of a speculative theological concept, but I do believe it at least fits theologically with the Bible. And that is, I ask myself, you know, we know about all these ancient religions, Canaan, Egypt. We hear about their gods, Isis, Osiris in Egypt, Baal, Asherah in Canaan, and on and on, Marduk in Babylon. And I think, you know, we're in a post-enlightened culture, and I mean, we predominantly consider these to be, figments of imagination. They're not real, or at least let's say they're not real. They're not real beings. They don't really exist. There's only one God. But if this notion, this biblical notion of these watcher gods over these nations is real and true, and the Bible says so, it's not polytheism. It's just there are these divine beings from the heavenly realm who've fallen from God. Well, I thought to myself, what if the gods of the ancient world, like Isis and Osiris, what if they were rooted in reality, but they were these fallen watchers, right? Because after all, if they're watchers over the nations and people are worshiping gods, what if they were masquerading themselves as gods? You know, so you've got these angelic beings and they're saying, I am Isis and Osiris, worship me instead of Yahweh. That's sort of the concept that I played with, because the Bible does say,
yeah,
in Deuteronomy 32 that, worshiping, sacrificing to pagan gods of Canaan was sacrificing to demons. So however you interpret that, there's some demonic spiritual reality behind them. And that's the premise of the series. So I wanted to depict what would that look like when God is judging, the gods of Egypt through these plagues, what did that look like in the spiritual realm? Mm. You know, we know the biblical case where, the Nile turns blood red and the people die and it stank and all this stuff. But what might that look like in the spiritual realm as well? And that's sort of the premise of the novel. And there's a lot behind it we can get into, but I'll let you lead with that.
Well, I mean, explain spiritual realm. Explain at least what that battle would look like. Are we talking about a battle? Are we talking about what goes on in and around an individual? You know, because there's so many layers to spiritual realm, right? If we're talking like an end time battle spiritually. Obviously, we can see that, literally whenever we read the text, this literal wars and fighting going on. But this spiritual war, spiritual battle, what does that mean for you, looking at it from a spiritual perspective?
Sure. Well, I draw my speculation from actual biblical texts. For instance, there's a story in the sequence of Elijah and Elisha, the prophets. In fact, it's Elisha, the prophet himself. And I think Jerusalem's being surrounded by, pagan army. And his servant says, what are we going to do? You know, we're going to be wiped out. And Elisha prays, oh God, open the eyes of my servant. And he looks and he sees in the heavens there are chariots of soldiers, heavenly chariots of soldiers, right? And that's not the only place that occurs. You know, we also have examples where, you have a single angel of Yahweh wiping out an entire, almost, what is it, tens of thousands of Assyrian soldiers in one night. So there are these angelic beings. And if there are fallen and good beings, you've got the both sides going on there. And so, like I say, that's about the most that we might get a glimpse of, there are other passages like, non-biblical passages that make this same argument. For instance, Josephus, the ancient Jewish historian, he wrote about the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, and he told that whole story in his books, Wars of the Jews. And he describes an incident where something similar, where you know, he was arguing that the nation of Israel was being judged for its faithlessness. That's why the Roman armies were coming and they were surrounding Jerusalem, and they ultimately destroyed the city and the temple. Never been rebuilt since, right? So it was a massive destruction and massive judgment. And Josephus said that in the time period of that, when Rome was descending upon Jerusalem, right? They were in the Holy Land and such. He said that they saw people in the heavens, these chariots and angelic soldiers in heaven, and that it was a portent of the destruction coming upon the city as well. Mm-hmm. So there are various cases like this. The Book of Maccabees also has it. So this concept is there, but like I said, those are the glimpses you get. So I thought of it this way. I thought, when we think of the demonic realm, there's room for variations. You might have evil spirits, they're literally spirits who do not have bodies seeking to inhabit bodies, but they're evil, they're malevolent, right? But these aren't the same thing as angels or watchers. Angels and watchers are actual beings, and the Bible shows them physically interacting with the physical world. Now, they're not the same physics as us necessarily. They can walk through walls or whatever. They've got this sort of other dimensional reality to them, but they do have a kind of, the Bible calls it heavenly flesh, believe it or not. It really does. And so angels and watchers or sons of God, these are beings that are the territorial powers. These are the principalities and powers. And so they have more of individual identity, I would say. And my notion was this. I thought, well, if the Bible, if what the Bible's saying is true, that there is this sort of battle going on, and you got the bad guys, most of the time in today's world, when people think of like the demonic realm, Satan and his minions or whatever, I think many people tend to think of it as sort of Satan and his minions. And his minions are this army, and they're all in lockstep, goose-stepping, right? Like they're all doing his command, and they're all basically in sync, right? But I thought, that's not the nature of beings with wills. You know what I'm saying? Like if there are fallen angels, they have their own wills, what they want to accomplish, right? And if they're evil, we all know, evil in humanity is very clear that, you think of the mafia. Yeah, the mafia is sort of working together, but within that, the ranks of the mafia, you've got a lot of them killing each other, jockeying for power, right? Taking power away, wanting to be the head boss, right? And so, obviously the same with gangs. You've got gangs competing against each other, mm-hmm. and sometimes they unite. So I conceived of that spiritual world in those terms. So therefore, and think about it too, the book of Daniel, talks about the spiritual prince of Persia fighting the spiritual prince of Greece. Well, if they're both fallen, why are they fighting each other? Well, I think it's for territorial powers. They've been given these earthly kingdoms or territories, but they want more, which is the nature of evil, right? You always want what you don't have. You always want what the other, you want to take it, you want to kill, right? So it would make sense that these evil watchers would be doing the same things that the kings on earth are doing. And so consequently, my story is Moses against gods of Egypt. I have some of these multiple deities. They're called gods, and for those who aren't familiar, I'm not speaking about polytheism. When I use the word gods, I'm using the term biblically. And in the Bible, the term God is used of several different beings. Yes, it's used of the creator God, and he is the God of all gods. There's no one like him. It's monotheistic in that sense. But that word God is in Hebrew, it's called Elohim. And it actually also refers to any being in the spiritual realm, which would include angels, are sometimes called gods. God's heavenly host are called gods. There's even Samuel comes up from the dead, from Hades, and he's a spirit being from the spirit world. He's called a god. And so, in other words, we have to understand that the biblical usage of that term God is a little bit broader than how we in the modern world use it. So, I've got these gods of Egypt, And I've got them struggling for power as well. Set, who's the god of chaos. He's got that strange, it's not a, they don't know what kind of animal it is, but it's kind of canine looking, right? He's not the jackal. The jackal's okay. Anubis, right? So you get all these cool images of all these various gods, but they're jockeying for power and trying to, and while they're jockeying for power, you have to understand that Egypt is at this time around the time of Moses, Egypt is encountering various other nations and they're trading with them. But also there was a time in Egypt right around the time of the Exodus where the Canaanite mostly, but they're Bedouin tribes and such, but a lot of them were Canaanite tribes. They ended up the Egyptians call them Hyksos. And there was a time when the Hyksos invaded and took over Egypt, and they were Canaanite, they were Semitic. So these Canaanite, in other words, the Canaanite gods of Baal and Asherah actually sort of fought with the gods of Egypt, right? And so I have some of that in there as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. One of the things that you're saying that I really like is the fact that, you know, everybody defaults to evil when it comes to the Watchers, when it comes to all of this stuff, spiritual warfare. We've got countless experiences and testimonies with demons. And I saw a demon there and I watched a program and there was a demon that jumped on me. You know, there's all these demon stuff. And even with the talk of the Nephilim or talk of the fallen angels or the chariots, the UFOs, the warriors that are in heaven, they're all the negative ones. The negative guys are everywhere. So it's really refreshing to hear you mention and bring up the good guys that I think that we have more that are for us, because that's what it says in that story of Elisha and the young man. He says there's more that are for us than those that are against us. And he's like, wow, they're everywhere, you know, these
excellent
chariots.
Point.
And so yeah. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just our theology or we just haven't, that wasn't like revealed to us, because not many people focus on the beauty of the angelic and, you know, that we have friends in high places, if you will. So to hear you bring that up in this
excellent
novel
point.
Is amazing.
Excellent point. In fact, so one of the running characters throughout all my novels are the guardian, the seven archangels. Now, the Bible only mentions the names of two, Gabriel and Michael. They're mentioned in the Bible. But in extra-biblical literature, the Jewish tradition, there are seven known. You got Gabriel. I don't know if I can think of them all. Gabriel, Michael, Uriel, who's another famous one. He's sort of connected to Noah. Mm-hmm. Sarakel, Remiel, Raphael. That's another well-known one.
In the book of Tobit, actually taken from the Apocrypha. Yeah.
Exactly. And Raphael, Remiel, Sarakel. I think I mentioned most of them. All of them, at least, almost all of it, except maybe one. I don't know. But anyway, point is that these seven archangels are main characters throughout all my stories, and they are sort of the leads who fight these gods. But in Moses against the gods of Egypt, I actually do have a let's put it this way: when the angel of death comes on the 10th plague to take the firstborn, he comes with his army, and that's how many people are slaughtered and such. But it starts as this glorious, you know, really a figure with a robe dipped in blood on a white stallion, on his thigh is written King of Kings and Lord of Lords, leads this army. In other words, pre-incarnate revelation of Christ, you know. In fact, there are many scholars who argue that the angel of Yahweh in the Bible is Jesus. And they get to that because they say that the Hebrew phrase angel of Yahweh is not.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It doesn't mean an angel from Yahweh, an angel, but it's like the angel who is Yahweh. Mm. That's what the phrase means, angel of Yahweh, right? And so if it's Yahweh himself, right? And then there's connections in the New Testament of language about Jesus that is also occurs with this angel of Yahweh in the Old Testament. So they make these connections and make a good argument that the angel of Yahweh is a pre-incarnate Jesus. You know what that means? Does that mean that Jesus was there on earth before he was supposed to be born? Well, when you become incarnate, that's a different physical human incarnation is different than his presence in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, his presence would be a different kind of presence, you know? Yes, a heavenly being. Yes, some kind of heavenly flesh because he kills people, right? So you don't, you know, with his sword and stuff. So, you know, that's real interaction with the physical world. But it's a different kind of, how should I put it? They call the word theophany. It's a different, theophany is the presence of God. So it's a different kind of presence than when he becomes incarnate. So no, he's not born. And this presence is a pre-incarnate. That's what they call it, right? So yeah, I've got some of that in the novels. Well, I like to bring that into several novels. For instance, you know, there's the famous story in Joshua where, you know, Joshua meets the angel of the Lord. You know, he says, "Are you on my side or their side?" Right? Mm-hmm. And he says, "I'm on no side. You know, I'm the angel of the Lord," and he's the one that sort of helps Joshua. He leads him in the conquest of Jericho and several other cases in the Old Testament, which I have written that novel as well, called Joshua Valiant. So I had already written Joshua Valiant and Caleb Vigilant, which is the two books that chronicle the two novels that chronicle the conquering of the Holy Land. But I had never written the Moses novel. So now that I wrote that, it fits in with all those novels in order, right? So, yeah. I think I lost my track of where I was going with all that, but I hope that...
Well, let me ask you this, because we're talking about the plagues of Egypt, we're talking about Moses and Pharaoh and those guys. Mm-hmm. Just doing a little bit of study, just throw it out there. Was Pharaoh a regular a human, a mortal? Or did he think he was a god? Was he a... it seems like he might have been one of the council that fell and started receiving worship of his own and kind of like making his own garden, if you will, my own kingdom, and hence the wars of the gods kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, Pharaoh did definitely think, Pharaohs thought they were Horus on earth. So, and Horus was the son of Osiris. And in the mythology, you know, Osiris was the king of the gods, and Set actually tricked him, cut him up into pieces, and sent him, you know, and sent the pieces all over the place. And Isis, who was Osiris's wife, she went and found all the pieces, put them together, except that he didn't have his male member. That was the one thing she couldn't find. So she crafted an artificial one, and because she's magical, she has magic, she made it magically work, and they had one night together, right? And before he went to the underworld. And so she sort of resurrected him. I don't know if you'd call it resurrection, but she definitely brought him back. And then he became lord of the underworld at that point, but she had the son Horus, and then Set tried to kill Horus. Very similar to the way Moses was attempted to be killed, which this will lead to something very fascinating. So the Pharaohs believed they were Horus on earth because Horus was sort of the earthly inheritor of Osiris's throne. And yes, Egyptian pharaohs believed they were gods on earth. And that is why they had things like gardens, and they sought to create that narrative around them. Now, I don't believe that they are members of the council. I believe they're humans who are claiming to be. But I would say this, that in the Exodus story, this is something that I discovered in my research that I brought into the story as much as I could. Don't forget, Moses was raised as an Egyptian. And there's good argument that he may not have even known his true Hebrew identity until he was, say, as old as 40 years old. Some argue that they taught him when he was a child, but nonetheless, I think there's a good argument that he may not have even known his Hebrew identity. So he has a thoroughly Egyptian context, right? So let's say he starts to realizes that he's a Hebrew, and maybe he does know a little bit about the Hebrew religion, but if he's writing, he ends up writing at least most of the Pentateuch, I believe, you know, a lot of it, not all of it necessarily, but nonetheless, he's writing this stuff. Well, the story of Moses, I found out that it's actually a kind of it's an analogy with the story of Horus and Set. And what's interesting is, I'm not saying that the Bible is saying that it's just using the literary mythology, mm-hmm. and it's saying and so Moses was the child that was born to inherit, so to speak, and Pharaoh tried to kill him. Right? Remember when he, you know, like Pharaoh did? Well, that's the same thing Set did to Horus, and Isis hid Horus in a basket in the Nile, you know, and. So I think the storyteller is sort of making connections. I'm not saying that it wasn't historical or it's just mythological. See, I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller, and if you know anything about mythology and history and history writing and such, there's all kinds of connections that can be made with myths and stuff, and it doesn't mean you think it's all myth. It just means you're organizing your what you believe is a historical event. You're sort of telling the story in a way that makes some points that you'd like to be made. And so so Moses has this connection to Horus, right? And Pharaoh is the one trying to kill him. So Pharaoh is like Set, which is the god of chaos, the hated god of chaos, right? Well, in the Egyptian, what I'm saying is, I think that the Bible is deliberately sort of mocking and inverting, or I like to use the word subverting, it's subverting the Egyptian mythology. Because the Egyptian mythology, so Pharaoh thinks he's Horus on earth, but the story is being told to say, no, you're not Horus. Moses more like Horus. Yeah. You're like
he's
Set.
He's the deliverer of the people. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're the one trying to kill Horus, and you claim to be Horus. So these are the kinds of things that I find fascinating in the text. And it would make sense if Moses would draw from that narrative, that mythology, to invest meaning into his true story that he's trying to tell about his past or, you know, his history, whatever. But those are some of the elements that I mm-hmm. actually bring into the novel as well. However, having said that, I do believe, though, that there is a spiritual dimension of reality that is in the Egyptian world that is probably more than just, you know, like I say, it's more than just beliefs. That we've all heard about the magicians, right, who faced down Moses. And the word magician is actually a unfortunate term. It's an unfortunate English translation, because the actual Egyptian magicians were in their own world. In Egyptian, they were called lector priests. So they were actually priests of the religion, and they had many duties, one of which was to take care of the temples of the gods and also to perform what we call, you know, like I say, I don't like the word magic, but they would perform the magical incantations and chantings and stuff to achieve something. But when I say that magic, it's not necessarily sleight of hand. You know, they could be liars in some cases. But my point is they honestly believed that the universe had a connection to words, and the words that we speak, if you could speak them in the mm-hmm. in the right incantational order, right, incantations or chants or whatever, that you could manipulate reality, and you can get the gods to do what you needed them to do for you. So this is why when you look on, when you see ancient Egyptian caskets and they have all these incantations on them, what those are actually the incantations for the dead to be able to say, so that it can ensure their pathway through the underworld to be judged by Osiris and to be judged acceptable and to go to the field of reeds. That was their belief system, right? So when you hear about the Egyptian Book of the Dead, what was that, right? Well, the Egyptian Book of the Dead was simply all these spells, and they were to help the soul make it through the afterlife. So, and this was something you had to memorize, because there are multiple gates you have to pass through, and you have to say the right words, right? But on Earth, those magicians then, Egyptians believed that, and they weren't just superstitious. They believed in the magic and the incantation, the power of the word. But they also believed let's put it this way, a rudimentary version of science or medicine. So they weren't ignorant, and they knew the difference between, say, epilepsy and a demon, evil possession, right? Now, we may disagree to where with them, what is what. But my point is that they were actually very intelligent, and they actually had this whole system. And this is why we hear about the magicians being able to reproduce the first three plagues of Egypt. Now, I do believe there might be some deception involved in there, but the Bible doesn't present it explicitly as deception. It just says they reproduce it. So Blood Nile happens, and then they're able to reproduce it, but they're not able to change it back, number one, right? And they reproduce it with like some water in a pot. And so the implication there is that that may not be entirely real, but it doesn't say that, right? They reproduce the frogs, right? But again, they reproduce it like the Bible, like Yahweh was doing it, right? And then there comes a point, and I think it's the gnats, the third one, where they say, oh, we can't do this. This is the finger of God. And the finger of God is actually also another Egyptian phrase, which is kind of fascinating. But anyway, that's the point at which they sort of back off and they say, we can't reproduce it. So was this magic real? They reproduced the snakes, the snake staffs, right? But then what happened? Moses' snake ate their snakes, showing the superiority of Yahweh. So all this stuff is at play in their worldview. And I try to reproduce that in the Bible, what that might look like to be living in Egypt. And the Jews had been living in Egypt for 400 years, and they were very Egyptianized. So many of them also worshiped the Egyptian gods as well. So it's a very interesting, complex cultural reality that's going on here between these two worlds of Jews living within the realm of Egypt and how they interacted, and how they were affected by each other. But the magic thing, I think, was a fascinating one because, like I say, nowadays a lot of us will look on that as superstition. Not all, but many of us do. But there's an implication that there's some reality to what's going on there, and some kind of spiritual reality, yeah. Right?
So. Yeah, and I've been studying, a lot of that lately, and there's little words, man, like you said, this the finger of God, and then just kind of like, oh yeah, the finger of God was against you. Hold on, wait, you don't know, that's a special spell and an enchantment that was used. And I was reading yesterday too, just in my studies, this idea, it's a great, wild idea, it goes really deep, but opening the mouth, the term opening the mouth. And even Egypt, there's a ritual, the opening of the mouth ceremony, but there was a, in the scriptures it uses, I know it's in Ezekiel, but it's talking about you're going to open your mouth against them. And when we read it, we're just like, oh yeah, it just means you speak in manner of evil. No, it means when I open my mouth, things happen. Yeah, if I say it, If I give you my blessing, you're blessed. If I curse you, you're screwed. You just are. Why? Yeah. Because my words carry weight. So this idea of the breath and magic is amazing. Yeah.
I was going to say, now, you know, how far do we carry that?
Yeah.
There may be, you know, different views of that. I know that many people today will take it to an extreme. They'll just, you know, they'll literally say, like, you have the power to create your reality. Yeah. Just speak it forth, you know. I can see there's a lot of problems with that. But you make a good point that the Bible has a basic concept of that as well. But what's interesting is that in light of that blessing and cursing, the Bible depicts very clearly that God's word and God's will for people transcend what they're doing. Because,
yeah.
you know, many times they'll screw up and they'll do the wrong thing. But God, you know, God chooses...
Use it for evil, which is what the story of the Bible, like every time
exactly.
they fell in, got corrected is because, hey, you guys did this for the wrong reasons. You
exactly.
know?
Now, one of the elements of this, so we're talking about how magic... So, by the way, so they would say the finger of Thoth or the finger of Set is the one that it gives this power, right? That's where the Egyptians talked about. But there's also this notion of if your words carry some kind of manipulation of reality, then the magicians or the lector priests, they sought to be eloquent of words. So that was a phraseology they would use, you know, that they're eloquent of language, eloquent of word, right? Which is interesting because when Moses, don't forget, when Moses got the call on the burning bush to go back, and he's like, no, I can't do it, Lord. He knows he's going to face Pharaoh and his magicians. And he says, I am slow of speech and I am uncircumcised of lips. And you're like, what does that mean? Is that just a metaphor for I can't talk well? Well, there's a lot more behind it than what meets the eye. Yes, he's saying I can't talk well, but when you look at the Hebrew behind the circumcised of uncircumcised lips, slow of speech, you look at the Hebrew there, elsewhere in the Bible, that those Hebrew words are used to mean stuttering. So Moses had a stuttering problem. This is biblical. Which is fascinating on many counts, and you've never seen that. I often say, well, that's no Charlton Heston, you know, from the Ten Commandments, right? Which I love that movie, and it's cheesy and it's classic, but I still love it. But we've all been infected by that because let my people go, you know, and he's just, you know, Brent. Well, guess what? He wasn't like that. In fact, he was very worried. He stuttered. So my novel actually has Moses stuttering. So I don't know if anyone's done that before. Maybe they have, but...
Oh, yeah, but, I definitely did. For sure. And
okay. But here's the thing. It's not just that he's saying I can't speak well. He's imagining, think about this. He's going to be facing Egyptian magicians who are eloquent of word. And his understanding is that it's like, well, they're going to have the powerful words for their incantations, but I won't be able to reproduce it because I can't speak the words well. So even Moses has a kind of a magical thinking even at that moment, see? But Yahweh says, it's not you, it's me. Go, I'll give Aaron your brother, he'll speak for you, right? And and God makes the point that it's Yahweh's power, not the power of the spoken human being, right? And so, of course, that's so profound on many levels, right? I mean, he's not only countering the magic and saying, this isn't magic, this is Yahweh. But he's also saying, look, you know, Yahweh is your deliverer. No human is your deliverer. Yahweh is. And that was Moses' main point, which is why, Book of Exodus, the Jews are pacifists. Because Yahweh said, don't fight them. I will fight for you. Which is interesting because once they escape and go through the Red Sea, then they start fighting. But until that point, God wanted to make the point that this is not you, this is not your words, this is my word, and this is my deliverance. So it's kind of a powerful, you know, I don't know, theological messaging going on there.
Yeah, I'm just looking up the word that was used there in that terminology in the King James. It says I'm slow in speech and slow of tongue.
Yeah.
Very heavy, interesting.
Or mine says heavy of mouth and tongue.
Heavy, yeah.
And then in Exodus 6:12, it says, I am of uncircumcised lips. So like if you look in other passages, the word for heavy, this is a whole nother issue too, kabed, it's uncircumcision or heaviness. Basically, it refers to the malfunction of an organ. So they'll say like Isaiah 6:10 says, their ears are heavy, meaning, and they're blind with their eyes, meaning their ears do not work.
Mm-hmm.
Their ears are uncircumcised in Jeremiah 6.
Moses have his sister speak as well? Miriam, did she speak for him at some point? Or was it Aaron the most
technically it was Aaron, but here's the other interesting thing. If you go back and read that story, you see, yeah, Aaron does speak for him, but Moses ends up speaking too. So it's like, it's not like he didn't end up saying anything.
Well, that's the weird thing, because like, as we're just dropping this stuff and we're students, like, it's almost like when we're talking about magic and being able to speak things into existence, he's like, listen, I can speak, but when it comes to making something happen, you guys are kind of gifted in this area. I need you to do it for me. Yeah. Just my mind is kind of, you know, going on.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I depict Aaron as being a very good, very eloquent speaker and such. And he actually inspires a lot of the Jews to rise up and join them. But here's the thing. But God had very specific purposes. He wanted Aaron to be the high priest. But Miriam was a prophetess, and it doesn't tell us anything other than that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask yourself, so they had prophetesses? What's going on, right? I try to bring some sense of that into the novel, because this is one of the mysterious things where it just says she was a prophetess, and you're like, well, who were the prophets at that time, right? You know, we don't know. But it does tell you that in that sense, Miriam, God spoke to Miriam too, but not in the way of leading the nation, maybe, right? However, don't forget, in Numbers, we read that Miriam and Aaron once they've been delivered through the Red Sea and they're on their way to Sinai, Miriam and Aaron get very jealous of Moses that Moses is the one speaking for God. And they say, you're not the only one who speaks for God. We can speak for God too, right? But don't forget how God thought about that. He cursed them. He gave Miriam leprosy, and he took it away. But nonetheless, he did that to say, shut up. Moses is the one speaking for me. You do your jobs, right? But it also shows God's grace. And that's another element that I wanted to bring into the novel, because you not only do you have a mighty God, we look up and we think of our heroes like Moses, and we think of Charlton Heston, but he's not. He's this stuttering guy, but God uses weak people to accomplish his purposes. And that, I don't know about you, but that's encouraging to me.
Yeah.
Because if you have this hero who's so great and mighty that you can't relate to him, you know what I mean? But but I can relate to Moses, and I can relate to his he had an anger issue. You know, you look closely, he had an anger problem. So I can relate a lot to him, but I also see that, you know, God doesn't use great and mighty men. He often uses broken vessels, and that's why, in order, like the New Testament says in Corinthians, in order to show the power of God, he uses these clay vessels, right? Well, it also shows the grace of God that I tried to bring out in the story, because you think about what Aaron and Miriam were doing. Like, it was pretty sinful what they were doing. I mean, it was like, it was tantamount to rebellion or insurrection, because they're like saying, hey, we speak for God too, and we want to be co-leaders with you. And God curses them. And think about it. Aaron never got to go into the promised land. And Miriam got that leprosy curse to shut her up. But God still made Aaron the high priest, and his lineage became the high priesthood for the nation, which, you know, the priesthood was surely as elevated as kingship, right? And Miriam still remained a prophetess. And so God is gracious and forgiving and patient with those of us who are, as I am, often an idiot.
Do we know if she had any children?
I don't know. It does. I don't know if it says so.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't.
If she was related to Samuel at all or anything like that, you know, dealing with the prophets in that order. One thing about being able to speak and to win people and, hey, you go talk to them because I suck. And especially when there's a lot riding on it. It's like a business deal or something. It's like, send Truth Seeker in there to speak, you know, like a friend in Ebonics. Say, hey, what's happening, man? What's going on? Or we can speak somebody that's really trained and they can really seal the deal, stay on topic, those kind of things. Get the idea of a little bit of when magic's concerned with the speech, Jedi mind tricks.
Yeah.
You don't want to go to war, do you? Let me go and speak to the king because I got that magic. I got a magic tongue. I can convince them. And we do see a lot of that kind of stuff with who gets to go and speak for God or speak to the pharaohs and Daniel in those things and Joseph, you know. Really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. And there, yeah, so there's all kinds of elements. Another element of it that I found fascinating was, it also says when Aaron and Miriam do argue against Moses and say, you're not the only one who speaks for God, the issue that they brought up was because you married this Cushite woman. And like, that's in the book of Numbers. And it's one verse, and it's just sort of, there's nothing else. There's no other reference to it after that. And if you look into what is Cush, where was it? Well, Cush was south of Egypt, and Cush had a very long history with Egypt above them for trading and also wars. They would take territory back and forth, right? Cush is basically in the Ethiopian area. So Cushites were black. And so, in today's world, the first thing people think, aha, see, Miriam and Aaron were racist. It's like, no, actually, they didn't think in terms of race back then. They thought in terms of religion. But because there were many different colors and shades of brown, you know, and so it really wasn't about the color. It was about the nation because Cush was always, Cush was a pagan nation. And I think the idea there was God was saying, you know, God did tell them, don't intermarry with the wives of these pagan nations because they'll pull your hearts away from me and you'll worship other gods. So I do think it's kind of rooted in a concept of that. Mm-hmm. However, I think what makes it wrong is that they fail to take into the account that even though God said that, God also said that he would accept people from every tribe and nation mm-hmm. if they would become a believer in Yahweh and join the body of the congregation of Israel. And they would have to follow the rules, right? So in other words, if they converted. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the first thing to note is that it really wasn't about race. It was about the notion of religious separation because of the gods. However, you also have to ask, where is this woman? You know, because the Bible only mentions one woman's wife of Moses, and her name's Zipporah, and she's a Midianite. And the problem is that Cush is way over by Egypt. Midian is two seas and a peninsula away. We're talking hundreds of miles away in a different world, closer to Arabia. So the chances are, she wasn't black. The only way that she might have been black is if she, Midianites can have, they're traders and they're nomads, and so they may have traveled and gotten multiple wives and such. So it is possible, but it doesn't mention that, right? And so there are different theories about who that Cushite woman is. Did Moses have two wives and one of them died? Well, here's an interesting story that I bring into the Moses novel. I try to incorporate as much of the theories as I can for different people's beliefs. But there is an extra biblical story that's not in the Bible, but it is in ancient Jewish historians, who are respectable. Number one, Josephus. He's a famous ancient first century Jewish historian. He writes about this story, as does Artapanus, another ancient historian, I think around the same time or a little bit before Josephus.
Is he Greek or Jewish?
They're both Jews.
Okay.
However, you know, Josephus is under the Roman powers, and I think Artapanus might, I have to look back into this. I can't remember if he's under Greek or not, but they both tell the story that we don't have in the Bible about when Moses was a general in Pharaoh's army. He actually led Egyptian forces down south because at that time Cush had stolen land from Egypt, and Moses was winning the land back, taking the land back, and he takes it all the way to the capital city of Kerma, which is in Cush. And it tells the story of how he surrounds the city, the walled city, and they're getting ready for a siege. And the princess of the king of the city sees Moses and falls in love with him. And they make a marriage treaty. And it's like, if you marry this princess, then the king will give over the city to you and you'll win peacefully, you know. And he does. He marries her. And she's a Cushite princess. And that's one possible explanation of who that Cushite might have been. But then you have to ask yourself, well, how come the Bible doesn't mention, how come she doesn't go with him? You know, he goes all alone into, when he leaves Egypt, right, he murders the Egyptian and he goes alone into the desert for 40 years. Then he meets Zipporah and marries her, and there's no mention of this other, right, what happened to her. Well, I try to give a reasonable scenario that's consistent with, you know, both this legend as well as the Bible in the novel, but you'll have to read it to find out.
Mm-hmm. So good. Let me ask you about this, just because we're, you know, it's part of the story. And in the spiritual connotation with it, talking about the warfare or what it looks like in the spiritual world, the plagues of Egypt, those plagues. I go back and read them now slower and get Charlton Heston out of my mind, which is hard to do. Like, it just is. But reading them slow, you're like, hold on, this is very strange. These plagues are, and these frogs and lightnings and hailstorms, listen, these sound like entities coming down to torment the people and maybe even mix with the people, and some of this going on versus just, you know, something we read it and take it literal versus
just
like
storms or something.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot more going on than just I'm going to kill you and your livestock kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I do believe there is more going on. And what I've come to sort of, how I've come to see it is this, you know, so if the Bible says that I'm judging the gods of Egypt and the plagues are judgment, now we know that it's against Pharaoh because he's trying to get Pharaoh to let them go. And Pharaoh thinks he's a god, but he's not the only one, right? So, and he says gods plural. And the immediate thing I think most people would think of is, oh, okay, so, you know, yeah, like each of the plagues represents different god. Like there's a frog god, so the frog plague. There's a locust god, so the locust plague, right? There's a Nile god, so the Nile plague. The problem with that is manifold, that I don't think it's that. And the reason why is because, first of all, there are a few of the plagues that could match up with some gods. Like I said, there's a frog god, a locust god. Ra is the sun god, that, you know, that could be the ninth plague, but there's only those few. And many of the other ones, there's no god of flies. So there are problems with it. And not only that, but these are all minor deities, that this frog god is, and the locust god, they're both very, like, you have to search deep to find them. Point is, there's no reference to the major deities of Isis, Osiris, and Horus. Maybe Horus, but for the Ra, the sun god, is connected to Horus, you know. But all the major deities are not in there, and that doesn't make sense. You know, if God's going to judge, he's going to judge the territorial powers, not the minor elements, right? So it doesn't make a lot of sense. And not only that, but there is no single god of anything. So, for example, the Nile, you say, oh, there's the Nile god is Hapi. That's a well-known one. And, well, I started looking into the various gods and finding out what they were. And there's a lot of gods in Egypt. And, yeah, Hapi is the god of the Nile, but he's not just the god of the Nile. He's the god of the flooding Nile, which is,
yeah.
You know, it had to flood to give them fertile soil. And it was all part of the system of agriculture, right? There's also a guardian god of the Nile who's Khnum. There's a crocodile god, Sobek, who's also a kind of a guardian god. I found about guardian of the Nile. I found about 20 gods connected to the Nile River. I found about, you know, 6 to 10 gods for each one that could be related to each one of these plagues, right? Like disease and boils, okay? There are several different gods of disease. And these gods don't have a single responsibility. They have a lot of overlapping responsibilities. Here's what I came to understand it as, is this, that the Egyptian system is not one-for-one gods of things. The Nile brought them life, and that was a primary deity in a sense, the Nile itself. But the whole ecosystem of where they got food and how they kept alive, they conceived it as a system. So they had a pantheon of gods, and they all had interlocking responsibilities and activities. And so, in other words, it's more about a whole system of these deities working with each other to maintain the system of life that they saw. So when God was judging them, I came to the belief, understanding that he's doing a couple of things. One is, yeah, he's judging the gods for that. But what he's ultimately saying is, your whole pantheon is a fraud because I'm going to dismantle the natural system, the nature system that you think all these gods are all working together, and none of them can do anything about it. They don't have those powers. And not only that, but theologically, he's doing what's called decreation. He's returning, he's taking this system of life and creation around Egypt, and he's returning it to chaos. See, things like swarms of flies and pests, disease, these are all chaos elements of nature that the ancient man, and we do today, still fight, right? And so what God is kind of doing is he's not only saying your gods are worthless, they have no power and authority, I am the God of creation, but he's also saying I'm reducing Egypt to chaos. Why? Because I'm going to create my people out of the chaos. So he reduces Egypt to chaos theologically by reducing creation to chaos, using all these elements, right? Blood Nile, flies, swarms, everything. Disease, right? And then he pulls them out, brings them through the Red Sea, which kind of cleanses them, right? And he brings them where? To Sinai, to establish his covenant order. So this is another thematic element that I bring into the novel to try to communicate, is that God is saying that this world outside of me, this Egyptian world, is chaos. I'm reducing it to chaos, and I'm going to pull you out and establish my order out of chaos. And my order is Sinai. My order is the Mosaic economy of Sinai. And that's what starts his people. So it's a kind of a creation story, isn't it?
Mm.
And that's sort of the metaphor of creation used, for example, in Psalm 74. You know, you see these and several psalms that talk about the Red Sea deliverance, but it uses creation terminology. I will establish the sun and the moon and the stars. What is he talking about that when he's talking about the Red Sea deliverance? He's saying that my deliverance of Israel and establishing of her as a people with my covenant is like a new creation. It's like a creation. And he uses creation terminology, and that's sort of that's the poetry that I tried to also bring in the novel. Well, you know, I'm making reference to all these theological concepts, but I got to tell you.
I'm hearing references I want to ask you about,
okay,
but keep going.
But fear not, it's my equally high approach entertainment. And I have a lot of battles, a lot of romance, actually.
Yeah.
It's my goal to have this as entertaining as possible. But with you, Derek, I can't help but get into the theology because of your, you know, because you have that interest.
I love it. I love it because it just sounds like, I'm like, did you do that on purpose? Like, is it weaved in there? Just the way you worded that, you said that, you know, God is establishing his people out of chaos. And we know the idea of order out of chaos. Everything's broken and ruined and order comes forth. It is the phoenix that rises from the ashes idea. But honestly, like, the out of chaos, right, comes the order or establishes a people that brings them to a mountain. Sounds very similar to Greek. The god chaos, that out of chaos comes the pantheon of gods, and brings them to a mountain as well, not Sinai, but the Mount Olympus. Was there a pun there that you kind of wove in, or was it like, hey, these are just these connections that have always been there through the allegory?
Well, I will make the connection to Greek gods and Olympus in a future story. However, what you say, I believe, is true of both Greek religion and all the ancient Near Eastern
religions. They're all borrowing. They're like, oh, that's good too.
Or another way of seeing it is they all have the same imagination. They have the same constructs. They have the same cognitive world, right? I mean, like what's the world we live in? So there's lots of genres and things like vampire stories, right? You know, so there are vampire stories out there that use vampires as a metaphor for, you know, sort of like eternal life and sexual freedom and
psychic
stuff like that.
Vampires,
right? Psychic notions. Vampires, you know. But I as a Christian, if I tell a vampire story, I'll tell one where vampirism is a metaphor for the depraved human nature, sinful human nature. Right? That's the thing that drives our bloodlust. Right? So we, in the same way that we use common concepts, but we appropriate them, we repurpose them for our meanings. Mm-hmm. So the ancient world also used common notions. And one of those common notions is the mountain as the habitation of the gods, mm-hmm. or a god. And it wasn't just Greece, you know, Canaan also had Baal, who was on his mount in the north, Mount Zaphon. The Jewish the pre-Sinaitic understanding was that the sons of God came down to Mount Hermon, and Mount Hermon, which is in Bashan, that became a symbol of evil, actually, to the Jewish world. But this mountain terminology is used by Yahweh. Once, you know, you read some of the Psalms, and you'll read God compares Bashan or Hermon, that mount of evil, he compares it with, or even sometimes he'll compare Baal's mount, right? Baal was supposed to be the high god of Canaan. And what was God, Yahweh doing? Yahweh was bringing his people into Canaan to dispossess them from the land. So he's going to dispossess the gods and the people, right? So there's many passages, even in the Psalms, that talk about how Mount Zion, which is ultimately the city of Jerusalem, which was kind of on a mount, not a literal mountain, but it was on a mount. The point here is theologically, they use mountains as this is the habitation of God. And ultimately Mount Sinai was where God first had that theophany of his presence and all this. But then ultimately when he builds his temple, it's going to be on Mount Zion, because that's where God actually will inhabit his temple. So you're right. You're right on with that. Egypt had, I don't know if they had any specific mountain, but they had what they call the primeval hillock of creation, which is that mountain-like, at least, the land that the gods create, they bring out of the waters, which is very similar to Genesis 1, right? And, So there's that, and that they're kind of connected to that. But most of these concepts do have this notion of the mountain. I'm trying to think of the Egyptian version of the mountain. I can't off the top of my head. I can't think of it. Failure on my part. But there's lots of things connected to mountains. Absolutely. Yeah. But the mountain in the ancient world, both Hebrew, Canaanite, Mesopotamian, And actually, in the Egyptian world, what are pyramids? They are man-made mountains. And the reason why is because they believed, and the Ziggurat of Babel was a tower that reached to the heavens, but it was a mountain where they believed the gods resided at the top. And so it wasn't, anyway, I'm getting off topic, but mountains were connecting points between the heaven of the gods and the earth, but also the underworld. So they believed they were very holy and sacred. And that's why they believe that on mountains or on ziggurats or on pyramids were this sort of connecting point with the gods and us and the underworld. So that's, yeah, there's a whole sort of narrative behind them that's fascinating. And I want to take this moment to explain. We've talked a lot about these theological concepts. Most of my novels now, I put out a companion book where I have the theology, the Bible study, and the historical and mythological research that I used behind the book. So if people are interested in where did he get this research from, is he just making this stuff up, or he's talking about all this ancient stuff, where does it come from? I have a companion book to Moses Against the Gods of Egypt, and it's called The Spiritual World of Moses and Egypt. And that's more like I say, I just give all the research for those people who like to do the research stuff outside of the fictional novels mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. And in that, in these books, I actually go into all these things that you and I have been talking about theologically. Yeah. Now, the concept about the mountains, that is in another book of mine. I don't have it in this new one because you gotta stop at some point, right?
Yeah.
But because mountains occur in all my stories, I wrote a novel, I think we talked about last time, Jezebel, and there was the spiritual world of Jezebel and Elijah, and there, you know, Mount Carmel, you know, the contest of the gods. That was where I explained this whole notion of mountains as connections with the underworld in the Bible and such. But if they want to get more of that, you know, historical, theological, biblical back research, get the companion book. And when you get the novel, I have a little page where it tells you, hey, get the companion book to this so you get all the theology behind it. So you don't worry if you forget the name of it. If you get the novel, you'll see the book awesome. Advertised in there, the research book.
That's so good. I suck at reading. Audiobook would be better. But for me, you know what? I'll probably go to the theology book and read that and get more out of it than actually reading the novel. I'll listen to the audiobook because I just really love the scriptural references, especially stuff we've never heard of. And I know that's one thing that some of us kind of, you know, pride ourselves in bringing to the table. There's other stories. There's other connections in there that we didn't know about and we forgot. And so you're able to kind of bring those to the table and read between the lines, people. These stories are there kind of thing. So I really appreciate your work and what you do. And I love it. And then to see that it was there the whole time. We've just been reading over this spiritual battle and spiritual Jezebel being spiritual, Egypt being spiritual, all of it, everything. Yeah. So cool.
Yeah. And that's been one of my interests. I'm just very curious about, I'm interested in other worldviews and quite frankly, pagan religions. I find them fascinating. They're curious. And I put them in their proper place, in my opinion, you know. Mm-hmm. But there are people who are really, like, I like to learn more about the Egyptian worldview and the Egyptian religion, even though I don't want to become one. It's it's fascinating. What was that like? And that's what draws me. But I want to retell it. So if you read my book, Moses Against the Gods of Egypt, you'll actually learn a lot about Egyptian myths. I incorporate them into my storyline, but I do so in a way that will, that elevates Yahweh mm-hmm. or the Bible over them. But they're still there, and I try to show them.
Historically. You know,
historically, I'm not just attacking them, but I'm trying to weave in their idea with their interaction with against the Jews. You know, and what I found is like I've had two different responses to these research books. Like they're saying, there's some who like to read the research first because they like having that in their head that this is real. Okay, this is real. I've seen the research. So that when they read the novel and they see the fantastical stuff, they get it and they're not shocked or they're not thrown for a loop, right? But then there's also people who say, no, I like to be surprised. I like the fiction. I like to get in caught up into the story and not get caught up in the head stuff. But then afterwards, I like to read, oh, where did you get that? Oh, that was based on real stuff. You know, anyway you go about it, it's you've got two things to help you out.
Yeah, that's so cool. It even reminds me of, like, you know, reading the book and then watching the movie kind of thing, where you got the theology and then you got the story, or then you got the story, then, oh, wow, it was there the whole time, which I know with someone like me and you and many other people, we can't watch a lot of these movies like, you know, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, or Lord of the Rings and those movies, or even anything on TV now without, wow, this came from Enoch. Oh, wow, this is that, right? And other people are just like, hey, cool story, bro. And we're like, wow, this is all from antiquity and it's woven in. Oh, that's Jesus. Wow, that's the Messiah. Like, those, you know, those experiences are so cool.
What's interesting, though, too, is that storytellers in Hollywood are aware of some of this stuff because they are incorporating it into modern stories.
Yeah.
Let me give you some example. And I wouldn't promote these because they're pagan, but they don't do what I do. They do it more, you know, let's retell these pagan stories. But I mean, of course we know the movie, The Gods of Egypt and Clash of the Titans, but there are more modern stories. Like, for example, the new Marvel series, Moon Knight. Well, he's a hero who is fighting the gods of Egypt. Now, they're good gods of Egypt and bad gods of Egypt. And, you know, like I say, I certainly wouldn't promote it.
Watched episode one so far.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it does get fascinating, and it does bring in the Egyptian mythology and the gods, and they're bringing them in as gods, which is interesting. Marvel's becoming more supernatural, you know, and they used to have just Thor, and now they're going to have this, and maybe there's more on the horizon. But there are other stories too. Wonder Woman, for example, the original Wonder Woman story, Ares, the god of war, very much was sort of catching this notion of, he was this territorial power who was influencing World War, was it one or two? I can't remember. I think it was two. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was two, I think. Oh, anyway, and they depicted it that way. So even Hollywood is drawn, the Eternals, another Marvel. I guess Marvel's
great.
Really being drawn into this world. Although,
well, Marvel is a god too. That's the...
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Marvel is a Greek god.
I was going to say Wonder Woman... Of course, she's Diana, you know, but that's DC anyway. But anyway, the point is that, Hollywood's using this concept of these territorial powers and spirits and stuff like that. So it's not just this bizarre, you know, unknown thing. People, writers and storytellers, let me say, are very aware of this.
I had a guy on a couple weeks ago, and we're talking about the goddesses of the Bible, right? We're talking about Iana and
Asherah,
all of them, right? Just because they have different names, right? The names just kind of keep changing, but it's the same God, just like Wonder Woman. You know, it's the same stories, just told over and over for the audience. So I asked them the same thing, and I ask a lot of people this, and me and you've talked about this many times, but like what you just said, really, like, you know, does Hollywood know this stuff? Are they studied, or is it just supernaturally these stories are being retold, or maybe the gods are putting on people's hearts to write this new story, but it's something very ancient? And and he thought it was random. He thought that these people had no idea what they were writing, but there's too much, like, they have to know, right? There's too much detail in there.
Well, I definitely think it's a mix.
It can go both ways.
And since I come from that world, look, storytellers, writers are always looking for something fresh that you haven't seen lately. And one of the ways we do that is go back into the ancient world, because they have a lot of interesting, they've worked out whole worlds, you know what I mean? And so why try to create a whole new one when you can draw from something? And there's something about, as storytellers, there's something about the fact that these ancient stories, whatever culture they are, have been worked out, and they've lasted for so long. Now, it's not like people worship Egyptian gods now. But what I'm saying is, though, it did last for thousands of years. So there's something behind it that a secular storyteller would say, well, you know, they don't see it as spiritual, but they just see it as cultural. It's like, well, there's some cultural power that's connecting with people. So I'm going to draw on that because that's fresh for us. We're, you know, we're in this secular world. And it's like, well, what if we draw from these ancient concepts, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, also ancient worlds also are always great for horror movies, you know? Whether it's Ghostbusters or, you know, just classic horror movies, they're often, you see these gods from the ancient world show up in horror stories, you know?
Yeah.
And I do think that it's even if you're secular, you just find this fascinating, different, fresh, so to speak, and curious. And however, that doesn't mean that they're not being, you know, influenced in some way by evil in some
it's
way,
so
because
weird.
Why wouldn't you want to draw people away from Yahweh by incorporating pagan notions? You know,
I mean, it's almost, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder for sure. And you know, we can watch the same movie again and see two different things. We're watching, you know, Narnia and
that's
Aslan
fair.
Is Jesus, the conquering lion of Judah, but to somebody else, it says, hey, cool story, bro. And even like Doctor Strange and stuff like that, like I've seen like critiques on a lot of this stuff where they expose it as being purely pagan. Well, if you approach it from that narrative, because you can watch the same movie and say, oh, wow, he's actually a good guy. He's one of the angels, right? And this kind of interpreting it from another ancient perspective of this stranger kind of thing. And it's been interesting. And I guess that ties into what I asked her. Commented earlier about the good and the bad and people only being drawn or only seeing the negative side, and they don't really know the good heroic stories or the stories of Michael and, you know what I'm saying, Uriel and Raphael and these guys who, and many more patriarchs or people who just pop up here and there throughout the scriptures and do like amazing feats or whatever. And we just kind of forget their stories and only honor like the demons and stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why I like what you're doing. You're bringing that part out, but it sells. We know that the horror stuff sells. You know,
I had to turn my heater off. Yeah. I had my heater on back there. I was like, oh, it's getting hot in here.
The horror stuff sells, man.
It really does. But by the way, I even as a Christian, I write horror stories where, I incorporate some of these pagan religions. Now, I consider them demonic, and so they're demonic in my stories. But my point is that I also still find them relevant. You know, like I have Baal, the storm god, show up in one of mine, but he's demonic. He's a demon. But the point is that the sort of narrative of Baal is the storm god of Canaan, and he had his consort in his sister, Anat. And, you know, and he ruled the gods. And I mean, even when Jesus comes in to the Holy Land in his day and he says, you know, I'm casting out Baalzebul, you know, that was a form of Baal. And so he's literally casting out this lord of this, you know, this place. And so I guess what I'm saying is, as a Christian, I can, you know, I use these same pagan notions as well, but I just show them as demonic. And and I think that's a legit way of doing it. But I do agree with you that, but I also seek to have redemption within my stories. Mm-hmm. I don't just want to focus on how bad everything evil is. And you're right. That's why we've got the archangels and stuff. So I also try to incorporate them.
The
as
heroes,
part, as,
like the good,
yeah,
the
heroes.
Good heroes, not the bad
exactly.
heroes. Exactly. Right?
Now, my novels tend to be traditional hero stories. Like if you look at them, they're all warriors. It's like Noah in my story is a warrior. And by the way, I think there's actually a good argument that he was. We all think of him as this old farmer guy carrying the animals up into the ark, but like that's a Sunday school thing. It's like that world was so evil, and the Bible says it, right? Every thought of man's heart was evil. Well, in order to survive in that world, you would have to be a good fighter. So my premise was, hey, he was probably a warrior. I have Enoch as a giant killer. I have Abraham as a warrior. There's another Bible character that you think, Well, wasn't Abraham the father? Abraham the father of faith. He's that guy who was old, and he had the, you know, the Abraham Isaac when he was really old. They were over 100 years old. It's like, yeah, but guess what? Genesis 14 describes Abraham leading a small guerrilla army against another army to rescue his son or his nephew Lot. So he was a warrior.
Yeah.
So, and of course, David, you know, and then Jesus was a spiritual, he's a warrior in the spiritual realm, right? If you read the book of Revelation, he's a warrior in the spiritual realm, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So I want to come back to, because by the way, I'm deliberately doing this because we're in a world now that is emasculating masculinity. It's seeking to feminize everything. And I love stories about women, and I love women characters and all that. But it's becoming anti-male. It's becoming sort of like, get rid of the male masculine. It's all toxic masculinity to them, right? Well, my view is like, no, there is toxic masculinity. That's the abuse of what's good. And strong, good masculinity is what I seek to promote and elevate. Because mm-hmm. I think it's lacking in our society. I really
Same
do.
Same thing with feminism. Like we yeah. healthy feminism, healthy women's rights versus
healthy,
like,
strong women. Yeah, yeah. absolutely. But within my context, you know, it's not, this isn't political. It's more just a matter of I want to tell stories that return to the traditional hero, because in many ways we've elevated the anti-hero now in our culture. It's all this cynical, nihilistic. A lot of these movies and stuff I'll watch, you know, like I started watching Peacemaker. That's another superhero movie. It was not movie, series on HBO. It's horrible. After one episode, it's just like, this is horrible. And it's just this dark, nihilistic view. And they're using superheroes to deconstruct superhero, you know? And The Boys is another one that's on Amazon. And it's, you know, superheroes are bad. Now, there's room for the argument that if superheroes are not gods and they're sinful human beings, then imagine a sinful human being having superpowers. I like that premise. But they're starting to become vehicles for storytellers to sort of express a cynical, nihilistic view that there's no real meaning. It's all just killing, murder, and jokes. And I want to get back to the traditional heroes, you know, where strong men and women, they're women with them, but since we're lacking in that, I'm focusing on these warriors in mm-hmm. the Bible and stories like that.
That's so good, so good.
Like I said, I gotta say this. I'm talking this way, and we're talking about all this stuff, but I want to say that my favorite character of all my novels is Rahab the prostitute in Joshua and Caleb novels. But also, I love romance, all right? So I don't want to just, to be honest, battles bore me, unless you've got a really good story behind it.
Yeah, action,
so,
action,
you know,
movies.
What I'm saying? Action's okay, but I don't focus on that.
Yeah,
it's,
you're right.
You know, and my favorite part of writing these stories is the romance. And so I have a whole story, a whole part of the novel is Moses falling in love with Zipporah and what their relationship becomes, because I love that stuff, you know? I mean, I love watching Bridgerton, you know, as much as I love watching, Braveheart or something, you know?
So let me throw another name out there. 1882, Yellowstone. Do you check those out?
I love 1883.
Battles, 83?
Yeah.
Battles and romance and great storytelling, great character building.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely. So all my novels, I seek to have strong romantic interest and connection with women, wives, and what have you, even though I'm focusing on these warrior heroes. Because quite frankly, without love, we have nothing. We're nothing. And so I want love to be as much a part of my paradigm as justice. Or
yeah.
And God,
I'm with you. Like, I'm a fan of horror. You know, I get criticized a lot for it on here. How can you let that into your eyes or into your imagination? Those kind of things.
Yeah.
And it's the creativity behind a good crafted story. Like, that's going to make you, you know, you know, gave a shout out to Jordan Peele the last time we talked about his movies. The last time we had, I really love his stuff because I'm on a roller coaster. I'm laughing. I'm scared. I'm like, it's making me think about my, you know, racism and stuff. And I'm sitting next to black people, and people are like, should I laugh at this joke? It's all in the movie. it was freaking amazing. I love that. He's got a new movie coming out as well called Nope. I just watched the trailer yesterday.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Looks great. But being able to go on that roller coaster with horror, and I know that's what you like as well. Good story writing, storytelling, and but there's sometimes you talk about the nihilistic. There's some of them more, and there's certain writers now that are doing it more than others that you can like. You can go wrong sometimes. You can watch it, and it's not a happy ending. It ends with a Christian having to repent and pray. Like there's some of those really dark.
Yeah.
Like when we talk about spirits and energy, you're letting spirits in your home. Like no. Some of these movies they're not all created equal. Some of them are really, really dark.
Absolutely.
Hereditary and witch and those things. Like I watch.
Yeah.
Just like we're talking about these gods, they are too. They're going back, like summoning and telling the story of these, not gods, but demons.
But well, look, as an apologist for the genre of horror, that doesn't mean all horror movies. I will admit that, yeah, there is a lot of bad horror with immoral, et cetera, nihilistic views or what have you. But I like to tell people, yeah, but there's a lot of romance stories that are just as nihilistic. It's just that they're candy-coated nihilism, right? Yeah. There's a lot of comedies that are very just as dark and destructive of people's souls because they mock and they laugh at things that are good, right? Yeah. So my point is that every genre has good and bad examples. Yeah. And if you want to be technical about it, Hollywood is dominated by, you know, mostly bad people. So most of the genres, a lot of it's going to be bad, but that doesn't mean good doesn't get through. And I give entire talks at churches about the nature of horror as a genre is just, and we've talked about this already too, where it's like, it actually is a moral genre because the whole point is to show you this is what you do not want to become. This is where you will end up if you don't repent or don't change, don't become, you know, and that's moral. It's just a different way of making the point, right?
Yeah.
And the good thing about horror is it allows you to deal with the supernatural world where a lot of these other genres will not.
Yeah, comedy,
and if you believe the supernatural world is real, well, then you get to talk about demons and angels or whatever in a way you can't, and even God, like, you know, the Conjuring series, you know, at least the first movie, you know, I remember, you know, it was like,
that's a good one.
Whoa, that was like a heavy, but it's a movie that Jesus Christ was the victory over the demon. So it's like, how could that not be, you know, Christian? Yet I know there are other demonic possession movies where it's more just about the power of demons, you know?
It's hit or miss, but if you're a connoisseur, like, hey, it's you what
know,
you
yeah.
do.
Yeah,
you
know? Totally.
I'm the same way.
So. Yeah.
Well, man, I've always enjoyed our talks and going on, see this podcast is when you get somebody that you can connect with, it becomes a roller coaster. It becomes a journey as well. We kind of cover a lot of stuff and this and that, and this is what I'm studying and I'm passionate about this. And that those are the best talks, the best episodes anyway. So appreciate you coming on and hanging
Thank
out.
You,
so, I'm going to put all your links in the description and they'll be on my website and all that, but let people know just directly where they can go to check out your books that good stuff.
Yeah, everything I write is exclusively on Amazon. Everything's in paperback, digital or audiobook, most everything. But if you want to know more about me, thegadawa.com is my website, and I got a lot of great stuff on there for you looking into all the stuff I do, and you can get a lot of information there. But if you just go straight to Amazon, you know, you can read about all the books and all the series and stuff like that, and get it straight from the horse's mouth.
Good stuff, bro. Hey, appreciate it, man. I'm glad we was able to connect again. Always a pleasure. We'll do it
Thanks
again,
for
brother.
Having
Thank
me
you,
on, Derek. You bet.
All right, brother. Peace. Wow, such a good episode. Thank you guys for hanging out with me, man. I love talking about this stuff and hearing other people's takes. And there's always seeds, man. I'm taking notes from my study. I'm in these Jedi mind tricks and the power of speech. Like I've been studying that a lot, but. Again, that notion of following it out of why Moses was like, hey, I need somebody to speak for me. Why? Because you're a prophetess. when you speak, things happen. Don't speak, so nothing will happen until we need you to speak. Come on. Those ideas, I mean, prophesying, speaking to the wind, the breath, releasing, creating. Man, all of that's in the scriptures. All of that's in antiquity. It's in Greek culture. They had different names, different types of breathing. And as we're studying this and rolling these ideas, you're finding so much under a layer of text within the scriptures. And my mind has been blown. It's been amazing. I love it. I love it. I love it. Hopefully you'll be able to see at least pieces of it, because, you know, wanting to like articulate it and really be analytical, you want to teach all of it. And so there's a hindrance, because as you want to teach all of it and study all of it, you end up teaching none of it. Even if it's just a piece of it, even if it's just the tip of the iceberg, that you can share that tip of the iceberg and somebody else will dig and we can go deeper. Because there's a lot that I'm being shown, there's a lot that I'm studying that I can't wait to really talk about. You know, I weave a little bit of stuff on the podcast. I connect with the guests as much as I can, but trust me, when it comes time for me to put that pen to that paper, pray for me, because there's some wild biblical Egyptian Greek magic within the scriptures that I'm finding that Paul was trained in. Moses, all of these guys working with spirits, summoning spirits. What? Yep. Crazy. It's amazing though. My mind is blown. So with that being said, thank you for the support. Thank you for believing in my work. Everybody who is watching this episode, everybody who clicks share and like and all that stuff, it goes a long way. But thank you to everyone who has partnered with me on Patreon. This is a listener supported, listener funded show. Doesn't exist without your help. Thank you for being enablers. Thank you for being my tribe. You guys mean the world to me. If you'd like to support, go to patreon.com/truthseeker. There you get access to my entire discography of music, 200 plus songs, Thursday night School of the Mystics, which is our hangout and discussions and prayer, meditation, all that cool stuff. And Sunday mornings as well. We have private Zoom sessions and it's usually a small group. So don't feel intimidated. Some people feel intimidated. Like, oh, I gotta join in at the beginning of the semester because it's a school. No. It's a hangout. We have fun. We roll ideas off of one another. It's like a podcast, but, you know, a lot more people. So make sure you check us out. I really enjoy connecting with the community, getting to meet you guys, all that cool stuff. So there's that. Our webinars, bunch of webinars that we've done in the past on breath work, on angels, all of this stuff, numerology. Go check it out. patreon.com/truthseeker. Special thank you to some of the latest patrons within the last week or so. Thank you to Jackie. Thanks for coming on, Jackie. Kayla Blaney. Thanks, Kayla. Great to meet you. Jasmine Joan. What's up, Jasmine? Welcome. Crystal Brown. Welcome, Crystal. Good to have you. Gerald Sloan. What up, brother? Welcome. Stoney Lee. What's up, Stoney? Welcome to the platform. Nicholas Hubbard. What's up, bro? Can't wait to connect. Good to have you. Shingai Chatawa. And I know I butchered that name. I'm sorry. Welcome to the community. I seen you join the Discord as well. Great to have you there. And last but not least, Kieran. Thank you guys for believing in the work and supporting it via Patreon. Check it out. We'll do it again. Many blessings. Peace. Your will is so much higher than mine. So much higher than mine. Your will so much deeper than mine. So much deeper than mine. Well, that does it for this episode, folks. To hear more episodes of the Truth Seeker podcast, head over to truthseeker.com. And if you're wanting to support the show and get rewards, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/truthseeker.